This week on The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
The push to have bigger families and more babies is part of a movement called pronatalism. They are freaking out about declining global fertility rates. And that is real. It's a phenomenon called birth dearth. What's behind this push to start a new baby boom? Who are the voices pushing for a more pro-family America? And what exactly does that mean?
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, streaming now on your favorite podcast app.
It's been 30 years since the massacre at Srebrenica, but the Balkans is still reckoning with its grim past.
Genocide denial and glorification of war criminals is more present than ever before.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today we ask, has the international community gotten any better at preventing genocide? Also today, the Russian Orthodox Church has canonized a new saint from Alaska.
Here you have a deeply rooted Native American population that now identifies with being Orthodox.
Why people get so bent out of shape when writers embellish their own stories.
Memoir sets up a kind of contract of trust between writer and reader.
And these home deliveries are going viral in Mexico. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here this Friday. We are starting today in Bosnia, near the town of Srebrenica. Thousands of people gathered today in a cemetery to mark the 30th anniversary of the massacre of more than 8,000 Bosniaks, mainly Muslims. They were systematically murdered by Bosnian Serb forces. It was the worst mass killing on European soil since World War II and later ruled a genocide by two UN courts. But even today, 30 years on, the families of the victims say they are still looking for justice. And as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, long-term peace in Bosnia seems fragile, too.
This week, around 7,000 people trekked through the thick forests of eastern Bosnia to the small town of Srebrenica. The 60-mile march traces, in reverse, the escape route taken by thousands of Bosniak men and boys who tried to flee Srebrenica. More than 8,000 of them were hunted down and killed by Bosnian Serb forces. Amir Kuladlic was among those who survived. Back then, the walk lasted for 7 days and 8 nights, he told Associated Press. Today I'm here so I can be with my son Sultan on this march. Some of those taking part in the remembrance ceremonies this week weren't even born in 1995, but the genocide still shapes their lives.
Two of my brothers were killed, Velid and Ahmedin. Velid was 17 and Ahmedin was 15 years old.
Mirela Osmanovic spoke at a UN memorial event this week.
Their remains were eventually found, but not whole. Even today, parts are still missing.
The genocide was carried out by Serb forces in the closing months of the Bosnian War, after the breakup of Federal Yugoslavia. The bodies of the mainly Muslim men and boys were dumped in mass graves. Bosnian Serb forces later exhumed those remains and reburied them multiple times to try and hide the evidence of their crimes. This week, a blue truck carrying coffins with the remains of seven newly identified victims drove from the town of Visoko to Srebrenica. Hundreds of people lined the route, placing flowers on the sides of the truck. This morning, the seven were laid to rest alongside thousands of others at Potocari Cemetery. Serge Brammertz was in Srebrenica today. He was the chief prosecutor in The Hague who oversaw the conviction of top-level Bosnian Serb figures like General Radko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic on charges of genocide. But today, he says, 30 years on, many perpetrators are still living freely nearby.
The sad reality is that several hundred, at least 300 names we are aware of individuals who are alleged perpetrators of crimes committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina are currently living a few kilometers away in Serbia or in Croatia.
And those countries seem reluctant to extradite them so they can face trial, he says, or even agree to prosecute them on their own soil. And there's another chilling problem.
We're living today in a society, particularly in the region, where genocide denial and glorification of war criminals is more present than ever before.
Bosnian Serb leader Milorad Dodik said this month that the Serbs did not commit genocide in Srebrenica. It didn't happen, he said. Srebrenica sits in a mainly Serb-dominated region called Republika Srpska. Velma Šarić, a local human rights defender, says children from the two communities, the Bosniaks and the Serbs, don't really mix, even when they attend the same school.
They do go physically in one building, but they have a completely separate curriculums. And then they don't even meet each other on the school breaks. They don't even interact between each other.
Šarić is the founder of the Post-Conflict Research Centre in Sarajevo. Some political leaders have little interest in reconciliation, she says. Their only interest is staying in power. And some days, Šarić says, it's hard to stay positive.
Now it's worse than after the war, you know. When war ended, I think people were exhausted from war. They were more optimistic and enthusiastic about the past. We had so much more like willingness to work toward peace. But now when I see where we are, it's difficult.
Peace in Bosnia feels tenuous, she says. Milorad Dodik, the Bosnian Serb leader, repeatedly calls for the separation of the Serb-run half of Bosnia to join neighbouring Serbia. Damir Kapidžić, a political scientist at the University of Sarajevo, says Dodik does a lot of talking, but he says there's little appetite for a return to conflict.
Nobody's willing to go to war again. There's no incentive for violence anymore. But in a sense of how you would describe the peace, it's kind of a very shallow and cold peace. There's no sense of a common community in the country or a sense of wanting to become one.
And for this generation and future generations in Bosnia, he says, that only makes the healing so much harder. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
Reckoning with the past is one thing, but preventing or stopping genocide or crimes against humanity is another problem altogether. Earlier today, I discussed that with Martin Shaw, a professor at University of Sussex in the UK. He said the NATO intervention after the atrocities at Srebrenica was too little too late.
It was only after that massacre and after another incident in which Serbian nationalists actually took NATO troops hostage that NATO and the United States actually intervened effectively and stopped the Serbians from doing what they were doing and forced a situation in which the people who were committing the genocide, the Serbians, had to come to the table and an agreement was reached. But that was a very long process. It was a process in which hundreds of thousands of people suffered terribly and many of them lost their lives.
I want to dig more into this. So Srebrenica happened, you know, decades after the Holocaust, decades after Never Again, after genocide was legally defined in the post-World War II years. Why wasn't the international community able to or willing to intervene prior to a genocide happening in that case?
The truth of it really is that stopping genocide has never been a major priority for big states and powerful governments. It has been something which the international community committed to after the Second World War because of the Holocaust, because of all the other atrocities in the Second World War. But they never really believed that they wanted to put resources into preventing this. States only intervene when they see it as being in their interest to intervene. And for most states in the 1990s, Bosnia was not a crucial strategic interest. Just like Rwanda was not a crucial strategic interest. And so they didn't intervene to stop it enough and in time to save most of the lives which were lost.
Right now, of course, there are mass killings happening in places like Gaza, Myanmar, Sudan. This is, of course, after Srebrenica.
Yeah.
Have we gotten any better at preventing this? Or are things much the same in the international order as they were then?
In one sense, things are the same in the sense that we are not effectively preventing mass killing, mass suffering, the destruction of societies, which is really what genocide is about. And we are seeing a situation where this happens time after time in all these cases you mentioned. But in another sense, something has changed for the worse, which is really that Western countries, which in principle were committed to stopping genocide in places like Bosnia and Rwanda, when it comes to Gaza, are not so committed because they support Israel, which is the state which is committing the atrocities, which is carrying out the genocide of the Palestinian people.
I will just point out that, you know, Israel says it is not committing a genocide in Gaza. It says it's fighting to prevent mass killings by groups like Hamas. And ultimately, that group is who's responsible for civilian deaths because it embeds itself into civilian life.
Well, Israel will say that. And of course, Hamas did commit terrible atrocities on the 7th of October 2023. But for 21 months since then, Israel has been carrying out atrocities on a much greater scale. And Israel is not simply fighting against Hamas. Israel is deliberately destroying the Palestinian society in Gaza. It is wiping out a whole society, a whole way of life that has existed in Gaza for a very long time. Most experts agree with me that this is a genocide. And this is something which Western countries, the United States, but also other Western countries like Germany and the United Kingdom, are actively supporting.
What about accountability in the international system of justice? Has the world order gotten any better at holding perpetrators of violence like this accountable?
Well, we did improve. After the Second World War, of course, we had the Nuremberg Tribunal and the Tokyo Tribunal, which brought the German and Japanese perpetrators of mass atrocities to account. And then we had a long period when there was very little of this. But then in the 1990s, after Bosnia and after the Rwandan genocide, we had the international tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, which did bring some of the major perpetrators to account. And some of the people who were most responsible for the Bosnian genocide are in prisons now in The Hague and even in Britain, where I'm talking to you from. So we did achieve something in that direction.
Martin Shaw is a professor at University of Sussex in the UK. And now a note on the end, ceremonially at least, of a conflict. Men and women in northern Iraq, dressed in camouflage military uniforms, marched in single file today, carrying AK-47s and other weapons. One by one, they laid their guns in a scorching bonfire. After a decades-long insurgency against the Turkish government, fighters from the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, ceremonially laid down some of their weapons. The ceremony took place in the mountains outside of Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region. This was a first concrete step toward a promised disarmament and peace process.
Çok ciddi hukuksal reformlara ihtiyaç var.
PKK member Bashay Hozat read a statement saying the group was giving up its arms by its own free will. She also read a statement from the PKK's leader, Abdullah Öcalan, saying, "I believe in the power of politics and social peace, not weapons, and we are committed to implementing this principle." Öcalan, who has been imprisoned in Turkey since 1999, urged his followers in February to formally disband and disarm. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, called today's event a great moment for the entire region.
Kardeşlik destanımızı çok daha güçlü.
With this wall of terror torn down, God willing, everything will change, he said. More pain and tears will be prevented. The disarmament process is expected to be completed by September, according to Iraq's official news agency. The PKK has long maintained bases in the mountains of northern Iraq. Turkish forces have carried out attacks against Kurdish areas there and inside Syria. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Olga Michael lived in Queethluk, Alaska until her death in 1979. In her 63 years, her life was one of faith and service, and the Russian Orthodox Church canonized her as a saint last month. After this ceremony in her tiny town, she's now known as Saint Olga of Queethluk, Matushka of All Alaska, Mother of All Alaska. Olga is the Orthodox Church's first native Yupik saint. The Very Reverend Father John Gillians is a priest in the Orthodox Church in America. He recently told the world's Marco Werman about Saint Olga.
The memory of her kindness and compassion lasted not just in people's recounting of stories about her, but in the native population there in Queethluk and elsewhere in Alaska, felt that there were appearances of her in their dreams. There were answers to prayers. There were miracles associated with her. And so it was a from the bottom up kind of appeal for the church to recognize her formally, even though she was a very humble person who didn't seek any kind of recognition in her life. That's really what prompted the church to formally take this action.
And a couple of firsts around St. Olga. She's the Orthodox Church's first Yupik saint, also the church's first female saint from North America. How significant is that?
It's hugely significant. Most of all the rest of the saints in North America for the Orthodox churches are men. And so, first of all, the idea that she's the wife of a priest, she had 13 children, five of them died in childhood. She had eight adult children. She now has living children and grandchildren still there. It's almost like it's a normal person being recognized for the holiness of their life in the course of their normal life. You know, she didn't have any formal position in the church. They call her Matushka because that's the Russian word. It's an affectionate title for mother. And priests' wives, especially in the Russian edition, are called Matushka as a term of endearment. But she actually lived that out in the village in Queethluk. So it's really significant that it's not just one more male saint, particularly in a church which is generally acknowledged as a very male-dominated church. The Orthodox Church is that, with its all-male clergy, all-male bishops. So to have this woman recognized, as I said, from the ground up, and then to have the bishops of the church say that they have to just acknowledge the sanctity, it is important.
As you said, Matushka, the word is Russian in origin. Can you describe the time of contact between Russian colonists and native Alaskans? Colonization, forced conversion, I mean, it has a dark legacy around the world. What was it like in Alaska?
Yeah, both sides of that story are true in Alaska as well, in some sense. Missionaries that first came to Alaska in 1784 often found themselves defending Alaskan natives against the interests of the Russian America Company, which also abused natives. So there were tensions there. But I would say on the whole, the church, the missionaries, took a very different attitude towards the native population. In fact, that first missionary group that was sent to Alaska were given instructions when they left Russia. They were told by the abbot of their monastery in far western Russia, they were told, you are to treat the natives in Alaska as if you are a guest in someone else's home. So I think from the beginning, there was a respectful treatment of the native population, which was also demonstrated by the fact that they translated the scriptures and the services into native languages, into Aleut in Kodiak, to Tlingit in southeast Alaska, Yupik eventually in the area of Queethluk. So there was this desire to really engage with the native population. And that bore fruit after Russia sold Alaska to America. The Americans looked at the Russian Orthodox natives as if they were pagan territory for evangelization. They simply did not recognize that they had been Christian because, in a sense, their practice was so native that it wasn't recognized by the American groups that came in to evangelize Alaska. So that sense of disenfranchisement and persecution also helped reinforce the native sense that we are native, but we are also Russian Orthodox. And that sense has, you know, persisted to this day, so that a place like Queethluk, it's very much felt that it's our native faith, even though it was imported from Russia.
What other remnants of Russian culture persist in Alaska today?
Well, particularly in the villages where you have these services, they're conducted sometimes in English, but also a little bit in Slavonic, which is the old form of Russian, and also the native languages, especially in the Yupik areas. So that sense of being partly Russian has been inherited from the past, and people will have even Russian names. So there is that sense of being connected to the Russian history of saints and worship from the past.
Now, the Alaskan Church is part of the Russian diocese, but the Orthodox Church in America is no longer affiliated with the Russian Orthodox Church. I don't want to get too deep in the rabbit hole, but help us understand how these lines of influence are drawn.
It's not that complicated in the sense that the Russian missionaries came in 1784 to Alaska. Then Russian immigrants came in the 19th century to the lower 48, to Canada. In 1970, the Orthodox Church in America was given its independence from the Russian Orthodox Church in Moscow. So the church, the diocese in Alaska, of which Kwisluk is a part, and which Matushka Olga was a part, it's called the Russian Orthodox Diocese of Alaska, but it's part of this larger group, the Orthodox Church in America, which is independent from the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia itself.
Do the church followers in Alaska feel very close to Russia and the Russian Orthodox Church there, despite the autonomous status?
I would say yes and no, in the sense that they love and admire the Russian traditions they've inherited through their village life, their church life in Alaska, the worship, the forms of worship, the history of the saints, and so forth. But it is not a sense of connection to Russia as it is now, or the Russian church as it is now, which is obviously a controversial concern.
And the canonization ceremony that we heard a bit of earlier, were there representatives from Russia there? Would that even have been possible?
Yes. In fact, the bishop of the Russian Orthodox Church, so distinct from the Orthodox Church of America, but the bishop from the Russian Orthodox Church, Bishop Matthew, was there at the canonization. And Bishop Matthew is also, he has a huge territory. He's also bishop of the United Kingdom. So he is Russian, but he's responsible right now pastorally for the United Kingdom and North America. And he was there at the canonization.
So, Father, do you think this is a sign that the church is recognizing the importance of its native Alaska community?
Oh, there's no question. Here you have a deeply rooted Native American population that now identifies with being Orthodox, who feel that it's their faith and not just a foreign import. So the Orthodox Church here feels very closely connected to the faithful in Alaska. They're an important, really essential witness to faith.
How does all this make you feel as someone who is deep in all this?
I am very grateful. There is a lot of pride everywhere in church life, and sometimes ecclesiastical power is no different from any other kind of power. And here you have a woman being recognized for her humility, her compassion, her serving of people. You know, I was thinking about this. Psalm 34 says, God is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Well, that's what she was doing. She was acting out of that sense of faith, of being near to those who are crushed in spirit and feeling brokenhearted. I feel that it's a sign of progress that the church can recognize such genuine, humble service and compassion in a lay woman who lived her life, all her life, in an Alaskan village.
The Very Reverend Father John Jillians is a priest in the Orthodox Church in America. He's been describing St. Olga of Kwisluk, Matushka of all Alaska, who was canonized last month in the Orthodox Church. More global news and stories are still ahead. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Israeli airstrikes on Iran have stopped, at least for now. Many Iranians are starting to get back to their normal lives. The World's Shirin Jafari spoke with some to see how it's going.
In northern Tehran, the Tajrish vegetable market is once again alive with activity. Vendors hawk their produce, masterfully piled up on large trays. Eggplants, avocados, radishes, and tomatoes. A short walk from the market is a grim reminder of a war that many Iranians didn't see coming. On June 15th, Israeli missiles hit a nearby square. It's not clear what the exact target was, but surveillance video circulating online and verified by the BBC shows cars being tossed in the air like toys. Shirin Rastagarpour shops in that area. She tells me when she heard about the explosion, she was terrified. She says she feels lucky she wasn't there on that day. But she heard the bombings every day. And she says the war has left lasting effects on her health. I feel so anxious and tense all the time, she says. I've asked my doctor to give me new medication to help. At night, she says, she can't sleep. The airstrikes were the most intense at night. There is a ceasefire in place, she says, but a ceasefire doesn't necessarily mean peace. We live in limbo. The war can restart at any time. To cope, Rastagarpur has thrown herself into working non-stop. The uncertainty means that she can't consider long-term projects, only ones that can be completed within days or weeks. Across town, Sina is digging through what remains of his high-rise apartment. His home was among the first buildings to be hit. In this video he posted on his Instagram, he pans the camera across his neighborhood. One building has vanished entirely. Another has a gaping hole. An older man on a nearby balcony hangs laundry to dry. The apartment right next to his is destroyed. Sina, who only shares his first name for security reasons, says a few days ago some government officials came to his house and asked him to file paperwork so he can get help for reconstruction. So far, we haven't heard back from them, he says. No news about how they're going to help us rebuild. For those near Iran's nuclear sites, anxiety is even higher. Sami Salimi lives about an hour away from Natanz in central Iran. That's where one of the nuclear enrichment facilities is located. The U.S. dropped 30,000-pound bombs on the facility last month. Salimi says he heard the explosions and feared possible nuclear contamination. It's really stressful, he tells me. Nothing feels the same. Salimi has two jobs. He runs a cell phone business and works as a driver for Snap, Iran's version of Uber. Just like many others in Iran right now, Salimi says he's worried about the future. He's holding off buying new inventory for his cell phone business because he fears Israel or the U.S. could strike again. So many businesses lost money during the war, he says. Some owners had to shut down for days on end. Even now, Salimi adds, people are avoiding non-essential purchases. They're trying to keep any savings they have in case the war returns. Salon owner Salome Zarandinia is also trying to rebuild. She says, we really don't know what's going to happen next. She says she has nightmares about the war, but she's been trying to get back to her normal routine. She started accepting clients again at her Tehran shop shortly after the ceasefire on June 24th. She's also trying to help others bounce back by offering discounted services at her beauty salon. She says, someone told me once that living with constant stress is like taking your own life out of fear of death. Let's not do that. I asked Shirin Rastagarpur, the woman in Tehran, what gives her hope in this moment? What gives me hope, she says, is the resilience of the people of this country. We've been through so many traumatic events and we've managed to return and rebuild. When the war stopped, another fight began, she adds, the fight to start over again. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The Salt Path is a hugely popular memoir by Rainer Wynn that has become deeply divisive in the UK recently, after an investigation in a newspaper alleged much of the story is not true. The Salt Path tells the personal story of Wynn and her husband trekking 630 miles along the southwest coast of the UK. According to Wynn, they had lost their home due to a bad investment and after Wynn's husband was diagnosed with a terminal brain illness. The British newspaper The Observer says many of these claims are exaggerated and doubtful. Elika Bomer is the director of the Center for Life Writing at Oxford University. She describes the reaction to the book's controversy.
It's been
extraordinary and ferocious. I mean, just anecdotally, when I was on a run yesterday, several fellow runners were talking about it, you know, who were running together.
your running group was even talking about it.
Yeah, my running group is talking about it. My book group is talking about it. Many, many other readers seem to be really impacted by this story and are filled with a kind of shock and a kind of disgust, really, that the wool has been pulled over their eyes.
Why do you think people are having such a strong reaction to this?
I think it has to do with the appeal of a story like In the Salt Path about healing, you know, about recovery, and the fact that, of course, the recovery happens in nature. You know, a lot of people, especially, you know, readers who are middle class and middle aged, just felt very receptive to the story as they perhaps are facing certain life decisions, perhaps facing, you know, illness of their own. It really resonated with people in that particular social bracket.
Mm. So I want to talk with you now about what the standard for truth is in memoirs. Mm. Because as a journalist, when I read a memoir where an author puts in direct quotes something their mother told to them when they were a little kid, I'm always a little bit irked. I'm like, there's no way you can remember that is exactly what she said 45 years ago. But that is considered acceptable in memoir. What happened with The Salt Path is clearly not considered acceptable. Where is the line?
Yes, well, you would think that the line would be very clear between truth and fabrication, but actually it does seem to be more blurred. The claim that memoir makes, you know, when you're in a bookshop, you're buying a book and it says it's a memoir, most people will imagine that, you know, it's kind of made up, but this was very likely to have been the case.
Mm.
But in this case, it's different. There's been actual factual claims that don't seem to stand up.
Mm. So what degree of creation should readers be expecting in a memoir? As we've said, The Salt Path crosses a line, but what should we expect?
I think the fact remains that we expect a true story. A memoir sets up a kind of contract of trust between writer and reader. The writer has a story to tell that they want to share with readers because it is a true story of something important and resonant which they feel readers will want to share with them. So it's really important to that contract that the story is true.
This controversy over The Salt Path is not unique. James Frey's A Million Little Pieces pretty famously was about addiction recovery, and that was found to be exaggerated. The 2008 memoir Love and Consequences by Margaret B. Jones was entirely made up. The authors who fabricate things in memoirs, why don't they just label them fiction?
Well, that's what I would say. I would also say, I think it's the writer, the American writer David Shields, who says, all writing touched by memory is fiction. And that creates a different spin again, doesn't it? That maybe the word memoir does suggest a certain element of fabrication is involved in communicating the story. But I would say that if a writer is uncomfortable with that, well, then they should actually just go into this huge new genre of autofiction.
Because,
you know, where you tell your story, but you tell it in such a way that is fictional.
What, if any, do you see as the lesson here for writers and for readers?
I think there are a number of lessons. I think it has shone new attention on that contract between the writer and the reader, especially when it comes to memoir. I think what's also interesting about this case is that it shows how hungry we are for stories of restored hope. And I think it's a real wake-up call for life writers that, you know, that readers want the real story, not a fiction.
Elika Boehmer leads the Center for Life Writing at Oxford University. She's been talking with us about the controversy surrounding the memoir, The Salt Path. Rainer Wynn has denied some of the allegations in The Observer. Her publisher has not responded to the World's request for comment. Who doesn't like getting flowers? But picture getting them this way, delivered by someone in an over-the-top costume doing a dance routine complete with blaring music and confetti. And obviously, video of the whole thing ends up going viral online. This is a thing in Mexico City, as the world's TV's Isaiah reports.
It starts in a children's classroom in Mexico City when a stranger calls out from the hallway.
Señorita Lili?
Miss Lili? The teacher looks up, a little confused. Yes, she says.
Le mando unas flores al patrón.
The boss is sending you flowers. No way, she says. And then, boom. A man in a flashy shirt and cowboy boots runs into the school courtyard, shouting from afar. Miss Lily, you're a lucky teacher, he shouts. Confetti flies, and pretty soon the whole school is outside. Miss Lily looks surprised, maybe a little embarrassed, but smiling. It's not exactly the kind of moment you plan for, but scenes like this have gone viral across Mexico, in restaurants, public plazas, offices, bus stops, anywhere. The man behind the idea is not an actor or an influencer. His name is Raúl Tupac, a biomedical engineer that came up with this idea during the pandemic, when jobs dried up and he had to get creative.
Y empecé a vender muchas cosas, o sea, he vendido gomitas, he vendido ropa, he vendido...
He started selling whatever he could. Candy, clothes, anything. Then he landed on something more personal, flowers.
Amor siempre va a haber, ¿no? Entonces, si hay amor, siempre va a haber alguien que regale flores.
There will always be love, right? So there will always be someone giving flowers, he says. Then he added music, sometimes live music if the client hires a mariachi band. He added a special dance, lots of confetti, and what became his signature shout from 50 or 60 feet away.
Señorita Claudia!
That's to catch the attention of the lucky señorita and anyone around, really. The flower bouquets are huge. The smallest have 50 roses, and others have over 1,000. So heavy that he needs help to lift them up. He's delivered them on horseback, by motorbike, even by boat. He always wears a flamboyant shirt and cowboy boots, a style that borrows from that of narco culture, that flashy world of drug lords and their girlfriends. Even the name of his business, Flores el Patrón, or Flowers from the Boss, is a nod to narco culture. Tupac says he's just trying to make people smile, and it works. His videos have pulled in millions of views. Most are sweet, with the occasional heartbreak.
Sí nos ha pasado que nos las rechazan. Hacemos todo el show y, oiga, no, dile que no, no las quiero.
He remembers the time a bouquet was meant to win back an ex, and she turned it down, on camera. That was awkward, he says. Raúl Tupac's idea has been copied by others across Mexico and even in the U.S. In cities like Los Angeles and Houston, you can now book your own patron-style bouquet, oversized, dramatic, and impossible to ignore.
Felicidades, felicidades, felicidades.
For the world, I'm TV's Isaiah, Mexico City.
Felicidades, felicidades.
That impressive picking is from the Winnipeg Folk Festival in Manitoba, Canada, which brings together folkies and performers for a weekend of outdoor music every year. This year is the 50th anniversary.
Molly's sweetly singing, tin roofs playing the rhythm, rivers rising faster than it should.
Artists like Steph Cameron have played the festival. This is Goodbye Molly from her 2014 turn on stage. The Winnipeg Folk Festival has grown recently with crowds topping 70,000, more than double the size of the first festival in 1974, back when it was the Winnipeg Centennial Folk Song Festival, which marked the city's 100th anniversary.
We didn't charge. It was free because it was a centennial celebration. We just wanted it to work.
That's co-founder Colin Gorey telling a local news outlet in 2013 about the festival's humble beginnings. But as fellow co-founder Mitch Podolak explained, it was never intended to be a one-off event.
We got funding from the Centennial Committee, right? But the plan was to start a folk festival.
Getting the word out about the annual event was not actually easy, though. Here's Gorey again.
One of the problems that we had was people west of Toronto, they didn't know what a folk festival was, and particularly the politicians that we were trying to get money from.
Potential sponsors heard the words music festival and thought of a much rowdier affair.
What did they think? Woodstock, which had, was 5 years before.
The organizers explained their more family-friendly intentions, and the festival was a go. 50 years later, the Winnipeg Folk Festival hosts artists from all over the world and remains a hallmark summer event in Canada. Here's an old recording of the band Humphrey and the Dump Trucks from Saskatoon playing on the main stage in 1974. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Sometimes to really get an appreciation for the culture of where you come from, you have to leave home and look at things from kind of a distance. Musician Alex Alviar left Quito, Ecuador in 1986 to study jazz in Boston. And it is here in Boston that he came to appreciate the different styles of Ecuadorian music that would go on to influence his own songs. Here's his take on the song Maki Mani Ishke. Our colleague Jared Bowen recently sat down with Alex Alviar in the GBH studios in Boston to talk music and cultural influence.
I'm curious about this exchange that we're hearing. You're bringing this music from Ecuador here and how these travels started and how this came to be here in the Boston area.
Well, to start off, Ecuador is a very multi-pluricultural country. We have 15 native Ecuadorian nations. We have 2 Afro-Ecuadorian communities. And then we have the mestizos, which would be the Creole people, who are the mix of native and European people. So it's a small package, but with a lot of content to counter.
And I understand that you came to appreciate these styles a little bit later in your life.
That's correct.
As a younger man. Mm-hmm. Were you averse to your country's music when you were growing up?
Not necessarily, but the problem with, I know it happens in different places of the world, but in Ecuador is a special case, unfortunately, that anything that is national, anything that has an identity that comes from either a native root or African root, doesn't get the airplay as, the foreign music and foreign everything. So I wanted to be a rocker when I was a kid. And I would hear the music on the radio, on the bus, on the street, in the store you go by. And the music was there, it's sort of in the back of my head, but I never studied it. I never learned. And until I think I was getting to be 20 years old and I hear for the first time an amazing recording of a group called Nyanda Mañachi, and it blew my head off. And something happened at that moment that I really wanted to learn and connect and feel, what all this rich heritage has to offer. I couldn't believe this was under my nose and I wasn't aware of it. So it was an awakening for me. And it's been a nonstop journey ever since.
I'm wondering, especially considering how you were staying away from the music for a while, the this was the national music. Has there been a change in acceptance and embrace within Ecuador of the music?
It's slowly growing, but we have a long way to go. I mean, one of the reasons why Ecuador hasn't been in a program like this or known worldwide is because we're a bit of an invisible being, because as opposed, let's say, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, their music is heard all over the world. You know, tango is everywhere. The samba, bossa nova, choro is heard, and cumbia. I mean, it's taken over the world because these are countries that really promote their cultural expressions. In Ecuador, we're way behind on that front. But it's something that the new generations are starting to connect with. So it's a long process, and it'll take time, but at least I can speak positively about that because it's happening.
As people try to understand what the music is and the makeup of it and the DNA, how do you describe the identity, the character of music from Ecuador?
A characteristic of native music is that it's very earth-connected. You know, there's a downbeat that's really strong, as opposed to, say, African music, which is syncopation, and the accents are in different places. But that's the yumba, which that's one of the first styles of Ecuadorian music that I heard, and I was blown away because of that power. It sounds kind of warrior-like, but it's got nothing to do with that, but I felt it so powerful, you know?
Heard, you're a testament to arts as well-being and what it can do for a person. But to that end, I'm wondering, once you embraced that music, how it began to change you as a composer and a writer.
Oh, it set up a before and after, definitely. I feel the need to have this Ecuadorian seal, you know, in my work, especially nowadays. Because it's, for me, it's a way to connect with my culture, and to also be, even if I'm a small voice, but I'll be, you know, waving my little flag, and here we are, you know, trying to get the music out. It's important for me to have that, and I don't think it's going to change until I'm not here anymore. That Ecuadorian identity.
Una voz que duerme abajo de la tierra espera por manos que la cuiden, manos que trabajen desde la pureza, unas manos que protejan el tesoro. Escuchar la tierra es el mayor legado para que esa voz no muera. Poderosos los saberes del pasado, protectores de la vida.
You will be forgiven if you missed the 2006 movie Snakes on a Plane with Samuel L. Jackson.
Enough is enough!
A seemingly endless number of venomous snakes are all on a commercial flight as part of an overly elaborate assassination attempt. Snakes on a Plane became something of a meme before memes were a thing, but the film itself was a box office dud. It turns out, though, this kind of actually happened in real life.
So basically, I got a call from Melbourne Airport or from Virgin basically saying there was a snake on a plane. Can you get here as soon as possible?
Mark Pelly, an Australian snake catcher, didn't face hundreds of serpents, just the one in the cargo hold of the plane, a green tree snake.
So there are non-venomous species of snake that you find in Queensland, and it's only a foot long, so nobody was at risk, and the airline staff did an amazing job. They did the right thing.
Definitely not exciting enough to be turned into an action film, but that little snake still forced the Australian domestic flight to sit on the tarmac for a couple of hours. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a fantastic weekend.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Janae Elzey, Vicky and Michael Isip, Genji Kohan, Ashton Peary and Kate Wolf, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.